All right, this is officially episode 2 of our podcast. In the first episode, I talked about the nature of God. What is God? Is there a God? What is the definition of God? And I think we can really definitively come to the conclusion that the existence of God is not necessarily a black and white issue. It's very much dependent on the individual's definition of what is a God. The idea that God does or does not necessarily need to be a consciousness in the way that we believe we are conscious. Could God be a force like gravity, or does God necessarily have to have a human-like personality? And then I did a little filler episode where I kind of talked about how you could get in touch with us if you wanted to. Again, the easiest way is to go to our Twitter, which is at Kanawan Temple. That's CNAWANTEMPLE, Kanawan Temple. And from there, our website is listed on the the main profile. And if you wanted to go directly to the profile, that is the Kanawan Temple at the Kanawan Temple dot wixsite.com / Kanawan. And again, that spelling is CNAWAN. So I think I want to talk a little bit about the nature of the biblical God. This is not a deity that I believe in. I don't think exists or could exist. Mostly because of the contradictions of the attributes of this particular deity. God is said to be... I've heard it called the omni-god, meaning that it is omniscient, knows everything. Omnipotent is all-powerful. Omnipresent is everywhere. And omnibenevolent, all good. Well, immediately, I think a lot of you see one glaring issue here, which is that if God is, in fact, all-powerful, then, and all good, then that sort of negates the whole existence of human beings. Because if God is all-powerful, then he could control our choices, meaning taking away our free will. In fact, there is some evidence that the biblical God is all-powerful in that aspect. The story of Moses in the book of Exodus, dealing with Pharaoh on a few occasions. Pharaoh, during the 10 plagues, wanted to release the Israelite slaves, and we hear in the text that God, quote, hardened his heart, which essentially means that he wanted to make the right choice, but God changed his mind for him, negated his free will, and made him make the wrong choice, which, of course, the contradiction lies in that no entity can be all of these things. The fact that God is omnipotent in this story, meaning has the power to change the human mind, means that he necessarily cannot be omnibenevolent, because he changed Pharaoh's mind in order to continue punishing Pharaoh. So he essentially forced Pharaoh to do something that was sinful in his own eyes so that he could punish him. That negates his omnibenevolence, if nothing else. And of course, there are other parts of the biblical narrative of God where we see him being omnibenevolent, but not omnipotent, in that he wants people to do the right thing, but he has no control over whether or not they do the right thing. So, a little bit of contradiction there. Also, if God is omniscient, he knows everything, then again, that has to deal with free will. And of course, that argument is a bit shaky, in that human beings we exist in a three-dimensional world with one temporal dimension, and so we see time as a linear thing, whereas any being living or existing in a way that expands on those four dimensions would be able to see what from our perception is our future without necessarily changing anything. We would have the free will to make these choices, but not being confined by one temporal dimension, you might be able to see ahead as to what choices we made without actually affecting those choices. But that's all just academic. And so I kind of want to talk a little bit more about the powers of the God that I believe in. The God that I believe in does not necessarily have to have any of these powers. This God does not have to be, and I try not to use pronouns because I don't think of God as a personal thing. Unfortunately, our language is such that we immediately want to call God he or she or something. I prefer it, simply because I don't think that it exists in any way that we can comprehend. And in fact, the Hindus, when talking about the Brahma, say that the one thing that you can know about the Brahma is that you can't know anything. The one thing you can know about God is that you can't know anything at all about God. And if you think about this for a minute, it makes a lot of sense, because God is the basis of all, of everything, of all creation. We live in three spatial dimensions and one temporal dimension. Our universe is very much a box, and God is outside of that box. God is, if you strip away everything, if you take away the stars and the planets and space and time and absolutely everything, behind all of that is God. However, we do not have the conceptual mental language to understand or even begin to talk about this God. And so, you know, this is why I say that I don't necessarily disagree with the general principle that the atheist brings to the table, in that there is no God, in that there is no thing that we can conceive of that is the God of which we speak. We absolutely cannot even begin to imagine or think about this God. Which brings me to my greater point, which is, by God's very nature, God has created a universe in which it is wholly unnecessary to believe in God. It is unnecessary. In fact, if you think of it this way, if you look out of your eyes, you have a field of vision, this pretty circular field of vision, and it seems to you to encompass everything. It's your entire field of vision. However, you can't see the back of your own head. And if you try to, there's nothing. You can't see. You can't even begin to move yourself in such a way that you can see the back of your own head. But the back of your own head definitely does exist. Now, obviously, it is not necessary for you to ever be able to see the back of your own head. It's not necessary for you to ever be able to see the thing out of which you see, because that thing, you know, is just there. It's the same thing with God. There's no need ever for you to understand God, or to visualize God, or to think about the will of God or the plan of God. It is wholly unnecessary. We have been given everything that is necessary. We have been given all of the tools and rules necessary to live a human life and to live the many lives that we will experience beyond human life, until we ourselves dissolve into the consciousness of God. I'm going to talk more about consciousness and reincarnation in another episode. But for now, I want to talk about what it is we do know. What is it that we are absolutely certain of? Well, we're absolutely certain that we exist. As famously Descartes said, cogito ergo sum. I think, therefore I am. It's a very common, very popular philosophical trope, but it's extremely profound, in that really and truly the only thing we can absolutely be 100% positive of is that there is something that is trying to think of what they can be absolutely positive of, and that is you, your consciousness, whether that is actual material consciousness, whether you are a physical being, whether you are a dream, whether you are a computer simulation, whatever it may be, you know that you exist, because there is a thing wondering about its existence, and that is you. And again, I'm going to talk more about that in subsequent episodes, but what I really want to get down to now is humanity and consciousness. What we do know is that we are here. What we presume is that other people are also here. Of course, we can't know that with 100% certainty. Every other human might be an illusion that is programmed to perfectly mimic an actual conscious entity. We don't know that for certain. So we're going to make certain presumptions based on our experience of the world through our senses. And I'm going to go ahead and take as a given that the world exists at very least in our own mind. So if you're listening to this and you can hear me talking, you know that the world exists at very least in your own mind. Now that being said, there are certain things that we can know about the world. And some of those things are, there is human suffering that other human beings, who are human beings just like us, are suffering. They're suffering from a lack of clean drinking water. They're suffering from a lack of food. They're suffering from war, from famine. They're suffering from abuse, torture, oppression. These are all things that we know exist, at least in the world that exists in our own mind. So we can know that as human beings, living in a state of poverty, oppression, pain of any kind, that living in that state is not preferable. What is preferable is to live in a situation where we have clean drinking water and food and access to medical care and all of these things that make this particular existence more tolerable. And we also know that a lot of us, particularly people that are probably listening to this, have the capacity to collectively create a world in which we can nearly eliminate, if not completely eliminate, most of these conditions that are not preferable to life. So what we can know is that we can help our fellow human beings who, and I will discuss this also in a later episode, who are actually not necessarily even our fellow human beings. They might be specifically us. Every human being that exists is a small piece of the universal consciousness. And so when you look at someone on the street, sitting on the ground, begging for change, asking for help, in the most selfish way possible, you can look at that person and think, that person is me. That is a part of me, as much as my left foot is a part of me, as much as my eye is a part of me. And if I get a splinter in my foot, I'm going to take that splinter out. This is not necessarily an act of kindness or benevolence towards my foot. This is creating a better condition for me as a being to exist. Now, if we think of the universe in terms of everything that is not us and the one thing that is us, then we're looking at the universe from perspective of the ego. The ego is the thing that is you, that makes you separate from all the other things, that makes feeding you more important, that makes clothing you more important, that makes housing you more important, and makes your comfort a priority. That is the ego. The ego is a very, very, very small thing, and the ego exists for a very, very short period of time. The ego is specifically connected to the physical body that you currently inhabit. The ego, in a way, is a good thing because the ego keeps you fed, the ego keeps you clothed, the ego keeps a roof over your head, the ego keeps your physical being alive long enough for the real you, the consciousness, the spiritual consciousness, to achieve whatever goals it has set for itself in this world. So, in some ways, the ego is a good thing. And that's why Buddha talked about the middle path. Some of the aesthetics at the time were starving themselves. They were dying of exposure, and they were denying the ego to the point of the detriment of the being itself. You don't want to do that. This is why I don't believe in sexual abstinence. This is why I don't believe in particularly restrictive diets, which one follows over their entire life, unless it is for specific health reasons. Because we can't deny entirely the ego. However, what we do need to do is understand that we are not that ego. That ego exists as a thing to protect our physical body, and our physical body exists as a thing through which our spiritual being can work. So it's necessary to maintain that body. It's like a car. You have to change the oil. You have to put gas in it. You have to put air in the tires. You have to keep it in good working order so that it can get you from point A to point B. But you are not your car. You should not identify yourself as your car. Because here's the thing. If you are your car, then 10 years from now, when the thing is beyond any reasonable amount of repair and it's ready to be shipped off to the junkyard, you don't go with it. You're not sitting in the driver's seat when that car is crushed into scrap metal. Because you are not your car, and you are not your body. Your body will eventually get old, it will wear out, it will be beyond reasonable repair, and it will die. And you have the option as a conscious thing to leave that body, to find a new body, to mingle with the eternal and immutable universal consciousness, or you can stay with that body and let it get crushed into scrap, and then you're done. That's it. You don't exist. You no longer exist. So, the goal, the spiritual goal, is to identify ourselves as the part of us that survives the death of the body, and not to identify ourselves as the part of us that is the body. Getting back to my original point, when you see someone who is in need, it is not because of some strange abstract idea of altruism, which we'll talk later. Altruism doesn't exist. It is a complete fabrication, and it is something that the ego has created to justify giving away things that would help itself. I'll explain that later, but the point that I'm trying to make is that when you see someone who is in desperate need of help, and you help that person, you're not helping that person, or you shouldn't be helping that person, because of altruism, because that is a supremely egotistical act. You should be helping that person because you recognize that that person is part of the universal consciousness on a grand scale, and the collective human consciousness on a more localized scale. And so therefore, that person is actually part of the thing that you also are part of. You are, well, I'll give you an example. You have a thorn stuck in the bottom of your foot. You use your right hand to pull the thorn out of your left foot. It is not altruistic of the right hand to remove the thorn from the left foot. The right hand isn't taking the thorn out of the foot because it has superior righteousness. It is taking the thorn out of the foot because the right hand and the left foot are part of the same body. They're part of the same thing. You are a right hand. Someone in need is a left foot. Taking the thorn out of that foot is not an act of selfless altruism. It is a recognition that you are the same spiritual entity as this other thing, and that you are both currently inhabiting human bodies. But at the end, the apocalypse, the Armageddon of humanity is actually going to be a collection of human consciousness into one collective consciousness. It's going to be the repair of a shattered consciousness. And there's a lot of ways to think about this actually happening, but of course, in the last 50, 60 years, there's a very interesting new way of thinking of this all happening, and that is the evolution of the human being from a biological entity into artificial intelligence, or what we call artificial intelligence, but it probably won't think of itself as artificial intelligence. It'll probably think of itself simply as the next step of human evolution. Now, this is just natural as Neanderthals dying and being reincarnated as human beings, as Homo sapiens. It's as natural as any other evolution. So that's one way to think of it happening. I'm not sure how it's going to happen. I wouldn't presume to predict that future. but it's important that we understand that helping our fellow man our fellow woman, our fellow human, should not be an act of altruism. Because the human is not the ego. The ego, when the spiritual body, when the spiritual person, the spiritual consciousness that you are, decides to help someone, to give someone money, for example. The ego has a couple of choices. The ego can either say, I have allowed the spiritual entity inhabiting this body to give away necessary resources that I need to be comfortable. That's not something it likes to do. So the ego invents this idea of altruism. The ego invents this idea of selflessness. And so the ego tells itself, I am giving my last $10 to someone who needs something to eat, because I am a good person. I am superior to other people. I am the pinnacle of generosity. The ego tells you that you are righteous because of what you are doing. And it has to do this because it can't justify losing valuable resources unless losing those valuable resources prove the superiority of the individual. And when that is the motivation for doing what you're doing, you take yourself farther away from the higher truth. You take yourself farther away from the higher reality, which is that we're all the same thing. That there can be no acts of pure altruism because we are the hand scratching the knee. We are the foot moving the body away from a predator. We are all part of the same body. And it is in the interest of the entire body that we act for the greater good of that entire body. And once you realize this truth, you understand that there is no particular righteousness, there is no superior morality involved in making the world a better place for all human beings. It is simply making the world a better place for the thing that is us. So, I think that's probably enough for right now. Again, if you want to find find out more about the temple and what it is we do and who I am, the best way is through our Twitter account, which is at Kanawan Temple. That's CNAWANTEMPLE. Find us, talk to us, talk to me, interact with me. I'm always open for questions. I'm always open for criticism. Until next week.